Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope you had a great, great weekend, and we have a packed show ready for you today. Coming up in just a little bit, another segment from The Tell, where we learned that wedding planning stress took on a new meaning when Libby Sternigan-Schwenk took in the April 2024 eclipse. Also, March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and we have a conversation that we all would rather avoid coming up in just a little bit. We talk about colorectal cancer. And we begin Main Street today with Division Chief Craig Nelson of the Fargo Fire Department. Chief Nelson, welcome back to Main Street.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be on. Appreciate you giving us the time.
Absolutely. This is such an important topic. This is the time of year where you're recruiting to staff the Fargo Fire Department. Why is now a great time to apply?
I was thinking about that a little bit, and there's several reasons, but probably the biggest is that the fire department only takes applications once a year. So that makes it really important. If you have any interest in working for the Fargo Fire Department or becoming a firefighter here for the next year, you have to complete an application during this open application period this spring, and then we'll plan on doing another one next spring. So that's probably the most important reason.
And I'm guessing that you have to plan training. It takes a while to vet applicants. All of those things make it so you can't just do this all the time.
No, and the fire department hiring process is different from many hiring processes in that.
What would an applicant go through if they choose to want to apply?
It takes a long time. So it starts with the application period. So we open the application period for roughly 2 weeks. It'll open March 31st and be open through April 11th this spring. And then after the application period closes, all the applicants that meet the qualifications then move forward in the process to a written test. And then we take the written test scores with the applicants, and then we bring in generally a group of 10 or 15 people that we'll interview at a time for upcoming classes, depending on our openings and so forth. A list is made from those interview candidates with their written test score, their interview scores, and then the chief generally gives them conditional job offers based off that list in that order. Then we fill a class, but it takes a long time to do it because of those steps in the process. But then there's also a background process too. And the background process takes bare minimum a month, but generally 6 to 8 weeks for us to complete backgrounds on people. And we have to get that done then at least before 2 weeks before the academy starts, because then they have to give notice to current employers. And so when we start looking at our next academy starting early August, we're looking at August 4th. Then we got to back that out. We got to have people notified by with final offers by July, and so then that pushes us back to June to start backgrounding, and then that pushes us right back into the interviews and application periods.
Firefighters are paid to train at the academy.
That's correct. Our firefighters get paid while they're in the academy.
If you were to tell me how many folks you hope to recruit, men or women, what would you tell me?
Right now, We're hoping to get quite a few applications. I'd love to see 80 to 100 applications. We currently have 7 openings, but that kind of steadily changes through the year. We have retirements and other things. People leave for other jobs or that kind of stuff. But so we might have, right now we have 7. By the time we get to the academy, it could be more. It could be 7 still.
So it's a competitive process.
Yes.
What qualities make our skills make someone really a great candidate?
Number one is people that like being a big part of the community. That's one of the things I love most about the fire department. We're very involved in our community. We're a very visible department in the community and very active. So we go to a lot of community events. We go to emergency calls all over the city every day too. But we're involved in parades, and we're involved in community and neighborhood block parties and that kind of stuff. So somebody that likes being part of their community and likes helping out in their community.
What if I don't have any experience? I've been working somewhere else, certainly hasn't been being a firefighter or with a fire department. Am I eligible to apply?
You are. That's one of the great things with the Fargo Fire Department, is that you do not need prior experience to apply and become a firefighter here. We send all of our new hires through an 18-week academy, and that academy covers their EMT, it covers their Firefighter 1 and Firefighter 2 certifications, hazmat, and all the things that they need to be a an official firefighter on the truck for us.
Tell me what that training time looks like. Give us the details of what someone can expect.
They can expect some long days. Like say we push people, but not too hard. We push them, there's a lot of studying. So they'll have a lot of times during the day, there's classroom, there's hands-on, and then they'll go home at night and they'll continue to read, review chapters, because every week there are quizzes and then there are tests that they have to take. And so it's a busy time for them. But when I talk to our recruits that pass the academy and get done with it, you know, was it too hard? Was it too much? They go, no, it pushed me, but it was a good way and a challenging way.
Is there support for folks going through that process? Do some people not make it?
We have a few that don't make it through the process. We do the best we can to identify any deficiencies in performance right away and then try and get them help. So they do a weekly evaluation with every recruit in the academy. Every week they go through that. We sit down with them. Here's how your coursework's looking. Here are your skills. This is how well this is looking. And then if there's stuff that they need to work on or they can work on, then we'll give them kind of that as homework or areas that we'll try to help them in. And if it even gets to a further point, then we will bring them in on for extra additional help from an instructor.
Enjoying my conversation with Division Chief Craig Nelson of the Fargo Fire Department. The department is opening up its hiring process at the end of March for a two-week period, and they are looking for recruits to join the Fargo Fire Department. What's a typical day like for a firefighter who just completed training and now is walking through the doors that I just came through a few moments ago? First day on the job.
We work 24-hour shifts, so they're going to show up. The shift starts at 7:30 in the morning, and they're on duty then till 7:30 the next morning. They will start their day off with taking care of the station, the equipment. We start every shift every day with checking out the truck, checking out the equipment on the truck, making sure your gear is on the truck, it's ready to go, cleaning the station, emptying the garbages, vacuuming the floors, taking care of the equipment that the citizens give us to use. And so that's how the day starts. We want to make sure that truck, if we have an emergency, it's ready to go and every piece of equipment on it is in working order and ready to function.
You say it's a 24-hour day.
That's
do
correct.
I work 2 or 3 days together, or is it one on, one off, one on? How does that cycle work generally?
It's scheduled for 3 days every other day. So none of them are, you don't work two 24-hour shifts in a row. You work a 24-hour shift and then you're off for 24, and then you come back for 24, and then off for 24, and then work your third 24-hour shift. So the three of them together, we call a tour, and then you're off for 4 days. And then at the end of the 4 days, you come back for another 3 days of every other.
One thing that people don't think about maybe when they're wondering about becoming a firefighter or working for a fire department is your retirement is there, and it's a little different and it's earlier than other folks. Is that still true?
It is true. Our pension functions on every year of service. You get a little bit more higher percentage. It incrementally increases over up to 30 years. But we can collect a check at 55 if you have over 10 years on, which is younger than most professions. But public safety, fire, and law enforcement are very similar in that they're very physically demanding jobs. And so that's part of why it's set that way.
I don't know which to ask first. There are rewards and there are challenges to being a firefighter. What are the rewards?
The rewards are you get to help people every day. And you're gonna save lives. Our personnel go on EMS calls almost on a daily basis where they save lives. So you will get to save some people's lives, and that's a great feeling. The opposite end of that is kind of the downside is that you're gonna see a lot of unfortunate situations that happen in society, and there are some lives you can't save.
So how do you help firefighters manage job-related stress, mental health challenges, and the emotional impact, the roller coaster that comes with being a member of the fire department?
We have several lines of defense for that. The first is just the crew that you work with. When you work a 24-hour shift in the fire department, you are assigned to a crew. That crew is always together for 24 hours. You have to be together with your truck in case you get an emergency. So that crew is kind of the first line of defense with a captain that oversees the crew just to monitor how everybody's doing. But it's really a good initial spot if you need to vent or if you're not feeling great or whatever to address those things. The camaraderie, yes. The second line of that, or the second, third line would be, we have a peer support team in the fire department, and that's our own shift personnel who are trained on mental health needs and have access to resources. And so that's another resource we have. And then a few years ago, we just added in annual mental health checkups for all of our people that are mandatory. So we actually, everybody in the fire department, including myself, go in every year, and we sit down with counselors who have training and experience with trauma-related issues, because that's one of the areas that we found the EAP program just wasn't as well equipped to deal with. But that is also another level we have there, is the city's EAP program too.
Chief, what would you tell somebody who thinks, I would like to do this, but I can't know now if it's for me? How can I figure that out?
I'm really glad you asked that. I would really encourage people to stop by the fire station.
Come
visit the fire station. Let us show you around. It's kind of we don't mean it to be a closed off world, but it's just kind of, I think people don't really realize what always happens and what goes on in a fire station and what we do. And so we love the opportunity for people to stop by, and we can show you the trucks, we can show you the equipment, we can visit about what we do on a daily basis, what the job is really like. And if you think then you're interested beyond that, then we can schedule you to do a ride along with a crew. So you can actually spend part of a shift with a crew where you ride along in the truck with them and really get a true sense of what they do. So it helps you decide, yeah, this is for me, or no, this isn't.
Does TV do anywhere close to a good job in showing us what your life is like? And I'm thinking of like Chicago Fire.
Things seem to get a little bit dramatic there. It's a little bit more run like a business than what you see typically in Chicago Fire. But some of the calls that they respond to maybe are a little exaggerated. But my gut says that they've probably been on every one of those types of calls. It's especially a big city like Chicago. We see some of the craziest things that people do with vehicles and the situations they get themselves in. So it represents it a little bit, I would say.
Where can folks go if they're really interested and want to learn more? What's their next step?
The next step would be to go to our website. The City of Fargo, the Fargo Fire Department webpage is under the City of Fargo's. Just Google Fargo Fire Department and you should take you right to our page. But our webpage, we have a careers page on there, and that has a lot of information that can help, walks people through the specific steps to get hired, answers a lot of questions. Then beyond that, then is the application, and there's a link to the application page on our careers page. So you can go right to the City of Fargo application page and fill out an application.
As we wrap it up, Chief, how do you know that the Fargo Fire Department is nationally solid, that is an elite group, so to speak?
Yeah, there are two things that we are very, very proud of. One is that we are an ISO 1, which is the Insurance Services Organization, our offices. They basically sell information to insurance companies about fire departments, the equipment we have, the personnel, the training, and so they rank fire departments from 1 to 10, 10 being the lowest, 1 being the highest rating. And in Fargo, we are fortunate right now, we are currently a 1. So we have the highest rating possible, and that for us then helps the citizens by them having lower insurance rates. So it helps, hopefully saves them money, would be the first one. And the second thing is that we are an internationally accredited organization.
We're hearing in the background things that we hear on television.
Yeah.
That the beep and then the notice. What have we heard while we've been sitting here?
So this is radio traffic. This would be from our crews that are out on a call, out and about, and they're talking to dispatch, our dispatch center.
My guest has been Division Chief Craig Nelson of the Fargo Fire Department. The department is looking for new applicants in their hiring process, which opens at the end of March and lasts for just 2 weeks. Chief, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Wedding planning stress had Libby Sternhagen-Schwenk feeling overwhelmed, So on April 8th, 2024, she ditched it all for a total eclipse. She thought she knew what to expect. A cool science moment, maybe some neat shadows. But when it totally hit, everything changed. The sun vanished into a black void. Her hands shook with something ancient, and for 4 minutes, time stood still. Turns out, some events just don't darken the sky. They illuminate life, as we hear in this segment from The Tell.
April 8th, 2024 was 5 months before my wedding, and my problems felt huge. The stress of planning every detail, making every appointment, deciding on decor, deciding on venues, balancing the budget, balancing everyone's opinions, all of these things were just mounting and mounting until I felt I was going to be crushed under the weight. So I decided to do something completely different and drive 2 hours south of my home in Champaign, Illinois, to a small town called Olney to observe the total eclipse of the sun. I'd seen partial eclipses before, and I thought, it'll be just like that, but darker. So I arrived a few hours early, and the energy in the crowd was palpable. People were laughing, playing music, setting up telescopes. I decided to pass the time by reading an online article describing some of the things you might observe as totality approached. The article described such things as interesting shadow formations, the diamond ring effect, where all the sun's rays concentrate in one point to form a diamond ring in the sky, shadow bands on the ground. As a scientist, all of these things were things I could logically understand. But later on in the article was something I couldn't quite wrap my head around, which was when it described that some people, upon observing totality, feel deep and visceral ancient vibrations. Ancient vibrations? That made no sense to me. I noted down the other phenomenon, and I largely dismissed that one. As totality approached, I began to observe the things that I had read about. 5 minutes till totality, and the shadows around me became crisp, like vision in ultra HD. 2 minutes to go, and shadow bands raced across the ground like snakes. 1 minute to go, and all the sun's rays concentrated in one point to form a diamond ring in the sky. My own diamond ring on my hand was the furthest thing from my mind. 3, 2, 1, totality. I whipped my filter glasses off and was confronted with the unimaginable. Where the sun had been was now a terrifying black hole that rushed up to me like the jump scare serial killer in a horror film. This was not the partial eclipse, but darker. This was an unearthly ring of blue flame hanging in the sky. This was a portal to another realm. It was the silver forge of the gods shining through the interdimensional veil. As a scientist, I knew that the moon was passing in front of the sun. But as a creature of Earth, I knew that the sun had been there, and now it was gone. And suddenly, I understood firsthand the term ancient vibrations as my hands began to spasm and shake in a way I'd only previously experienced in the moments before passing out cold. Totality lasted 4 minutes, but for me, time stood still. An eternity of suspended animation, just me and the eclipse. When the 4 minutes had passed, I observed all the same things again: the diamond ring in the sky, the shadow bands on the ground, the crisp shadows all around. Everyone around me clapped their hands and went on with their day. The world around me was the same as it had been 5 minutes previously, but I felt changed. Suddenly, this crowd of strangers were strangers no more, and each one was the most important person on the planet. The worries of the world seemed insignificant in light of our shared humanity. April 8th, 2024 was still just 5 months till my wedding. And I realized that my problems felt huge, but they were small. And every moment of our shared existence in this wide and wonderful universe, every single one of those moments is precious.
A total eclipse of the sun, recalibrating the stress of planning a wedding. That was Libby Sternhagen-Schwenk's story from the February's Tell Show. The next live storytelling event at the 4x4 above Side Street in downtown Fargo is set for Thursday, April 10th at 7 o'clock. More information on the Tell is available on their Facebook or Instagram social media pages. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Food deserts have grown across the rural Midwest, largely due to the disappearance of independent grocery stores. To push back against this trend, more states have created grant programs to support small grocers. As Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports, the stores are part of the backbone for many rural communities.
In the back room at Wood Supermarket in Delhi, Kent Wood and his son pull the plastic away from a pallet stacked with boxes. One contains bottles of ketchup, others hold canned soup and pasta.
04512.
While unloading, they call out numbers printed on each box to check off inventory.
And then a 21.
On truck delivery days, Kent gets here at 4:30 a.m.
I wouldn't come to work and work as many hours as I do if I didn't like it.
Wood Supermarket in Delhi sits in front of a grain elevator in Pocahontas, a town of about 1,800 people in northwest Iowa. While a few dollar stores sell food, this is the only grocery store in town. Kent's wife and store co-owner, Kim Wood, says the closest alternatives are outside the county lines, about 20 to 30 minutes away.
Yeah, the elderly population, especially in the wintertime, they don't want to drive out of town to get groceries, and I think that would be a hardship.
Rural policy experts say grocery stores are vital for communities to thrive. But the number of rural independent grocery stores in the U.S. has steadily declined in recent decades. To help reverse this trend, half a dozen states, including Illinois, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Oklahoma, have passed legislation in recent years to develop grant programs for grocers. Now, lawmakers in Iowa and Nebraska are pushing to create their own versions. Jillian Linster is the Senior Director of Policy at the Center for Rural Affairs. The organization is advocating for both bills.
Our staff live and work in the communities that we serve. And so we were seeing in our everyday lives that more and more stores were closing or struggling to stay open.
A recent study found the number of rural independent grocery stores in Nebraska declined by 30% from 2016 to 2021.
Rural independent grocers are operating on extremely slim profit margins, sometimes as little as 1%.
Competition with dollar stores and supercenters in the region are one of the biggest challenges for independent grocers. Fewer customers from population loss, rising operating costs, and aging equipment are also factors. Chad Engels is one of the Republican representatives who introduced the Grocer Reinvestment Bill in Iowa. During a noisy subcommittee meeting, he said a grant program could make a big difference for mom-and-pop grocery stores.
And I hear from all of them, we're just one freezer breakdown, one cooler breakdown from shutting the door.
While the Nebraska and Iowa bills are slightly different, they both aim to help rural independent grocers pay for things like new equipment and utility upgrades. Funds from the Nebraska program could also be used to explore new business models, like purchasing cooperatives. This is something Liz Ravenscroft says she wants to explore if the grant program gets off the ground.
The problem with our remote location is we are unable to sell a minimum amount that certain companies require for groceries.
She manages Circle C Market, a nonprofit grocery store affiliated with a school in Cody, Nebraska. Population, 170. Ravenscroft says some of their customers come from an hour away to buy milk, bread, and other essentials. By creating a purchasing cooperative with other retailers in North Central Nebraska, Ravenscroft says they could order directly from a wholesaler and pass savings on to customers.
You know, we're always looking for ways to get groceries at a more affordable cost for our customers. That's the bottom line.
Ravenscroft, also a full-time business teacher, says managing Circle C Market requires a lot of time, but it's a labor of love. She wants to support her community. In the break room at Wood Supermarket and Deli in Pocahontas, Kent and Kim Wood say the same thing. Many of their customers are people they've known for decades. When one had a health issue recently, they helped out by delivering her groceries.
I mean, that's what you do in a small town. You look out for each other. No.
Rural advocates in Iowa and Nebraska say it makes sense for states to look after small town grocers in return. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest, who reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues. Coming up on Main Street, an important discussion. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and we're not going to ignore it because doing so could be deadly. That's after this. Welcome back to Main Street on this Monday on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, and last week I sat down with Dr. Kimberly Colkhurst, she's a gastroenterologist at Essentia Health, and Dr. Dustin Nowotny, he is a general surgeon. For some, this may be a difficult conversation, but there are screenings, and we'll learn about the life-saving power of early detection.
Dr. Colkhurst, welcome to Main Street.
Great, thanks. Happy to be here.
Dustin, thank you very much for joining us. Recent studies have shown an increase in colorectal cancer cases. What do we know about that here in North Dakota?
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for having us, Prairie Public and Essentia Health. This is such an important topic, and thank you to all the listeners that are listening today because we need to talk about this. We need to spread awareness. Yes, colorectal cancer is on the rise. This is a disease that it can affect anybody, you know, even if you don't have a family history of colon cancer. It's something we need to talk about. We need to be aware of what the symptoms are. We want to really try to spread awareness because this is something you want to find early if you have it. The earlier you catch it, the better off that you're going to be in the long run.
Dr. Nowotny, people under 50 are more often getting colorectal cancer. Is that accurate?
Yeah, those patients or those people under 50 are being, they have exposures and they are being diagnosed more frequently than they used to.
Is it we're diagnosing better or the fact that there really are more cancers in people that are younger?
I would say it's probably a little bit of both. We have more colonoscopy, more technique and technology to help diagnose these things, and more people are aware of it and are looking to get studied, and we have patients all the time come in and be like, I just want a colonoscopy. Are you able to kind of set that up for us? And we're able to lots of times accommodate that.
Symptoms. What are typical symptoms that people should watch out for? Or are there no symptoms in the early stages of the disease?
That is correct. That's something to point out is that some patients don't have symptoms. So that's why once you're at that age that you qualify for screening, which I'm sure we'll get to, you should just get the screening because you could have no symptoms. But the other symptoms that you could present with would be blood in the stools, change in bowel habits, new onset constipation, new onset diarrhea, abdominal pain, unintentional weight loss. And then you also want to look at if you have any family history of colon cancer or any personal history of colon polyps. And then other patients that have familial polyposis syndromes or even inflammatory bowel disease are at higher risk for colon cancer.
So it seems to me that guidelines have changed. We just talked about that maybe there are more incidents of colorectal cancer in people under 50.
That's correct.
Who should be tested?
So right now, colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in the United States. We see that there is a rise in young people, and it's interesting because men under the age of 50, colorectal cancer is actually the number one cause of death for men under the age of 50. And then in May of 2021, they actually decreased the screening age. It used to be that we would start the screening colonoscopies at the age of 50, and because of the rise in colorectal cancer in younger patients, we are now starting to screen at the age of 45. And so now we have all these patients between 45 and 50 that it's like, oh, surprise, they go to their primary care doctor. It's like, actually, you are due for a colonoscopy now. But this is a really good thing because we are finding polyps. We're taking polyps out in these patients to help prevent colon cancer. And or if we're finding cancer, then hopefully that means we're going to find it earlier so you'll have a better outcome.
Dr. Nowotny, I think there are people out there, and I may have been one of these people, who are afraid to do this. It's a hard decision for some. It's the right thing to do. We all know that. What would you tell those folks?
I mean, I want to stress the benefits of colonoscopy. If they do end up finding something, getting something treated, potentially during that colonoscopy where it doesn't ever develop into something, or early enough where we're able to treat it successfully without any additional treatment afterwards is always an important thing. People get this done every day. Lots of times there's excellent medications and most patients are fairly comfortable throughout the entire procedure. it is an invasive procedure. You do have to take time out of work, but lots of times it's worth it for the health of your ongoing life.
I think I've seen in my Facebook feed, of all places, there are screenings, alternatives to colorectal cancer. What should we think about those alternatives? Are they worthwhile, or is this a gold standard?
Well, yeah, any screening is better than nothing. Colonoscopy is definitely the gold standard because we can remove the polyps to prevent colon cancer and diagnose at the same time. So it's a diagnostic and therapeutic procedure at the same time. Plus, you get the reassurance of knowing and saying, okay, I know exactly what's going on in my colon. But the other options are a Cologuard test, which detects DNA that's associated with colon cancer. And then you can also have a fecal occult blood test. And then there's other things like a colonography, that's an imaging study. It's not done at all hospitals, but that's, you still have to take a prep for that. And that's what I want to say about colonoscopy is that, you know, people chalk it up in their minds as, oh, it's this terrible thing. But then afterwards, I'm telling you, like 90% of my patients are like, that was way easier than I thought it was going to be. The prep is the worst part. You know, but you don't have to starve yourself. You still get to have a clear liquid diet the day before. Drink lots of fluid, drink lots of broth, jello, stay hydrated, get cleaned out, come in, get it done. One day, it's one day of your life, and it's really well worth it.
And then go have a hamburger afterwards.
And then go, yep, exactly, yep.
Go ahead.
I would echo what Dr. Kolkor said. Anything is better than nothing. It's just like exercise. Any sort of exercise is better than nothing. Any sort of screening or testing is going to be better than nothing, especially for those patients that don't have increased risk, such as family histories and stuff like that.
It seems to me, hard to talk about, the prep part of this has also changed over the last decade or so, even when I had my first colonoscopy. Has it changed? Are there new and better ways to do this?
Yes, so every patient will always say, you know, can you make it so we don't have to take a prep? And it's like, well, you know, you just can't, because you have to visualize, like, if you think of a clog in a sink, you know, to get the sink unclogged, you're going to have to take medication or a chemical to push it through, and then you need volume to push it through. So it's going to take, you know, pills and then liquid. But what we've been doing over time is we're trying to decrease the amount of volume that the patients have to take, because sometimes it's just they're drinking so much and they feel just nauseated. So what we've done is we've adapted more split dose prepping. So you can take pills and powder, and then pills and powder, and then that gets the job done, just splitting things up a little bit more. Or sometimes different facilities are still using Go Lightly, that which is that gallon that makes you go heavily instead. But instead of having you drink it all at once, they're splitting it up into the split dose prepping.
Talked earlier about folks who have a family history. What if I'm not sure about my family history? I know my parents, but shoot, I don't know what my grandparents' health issues were. They were old in my eyes, right? Does that at all factor? Let me ask it this way. Are there other tests that tell whether someone's predisposed to having colorectal cancer?
That comes up a lot, because especially when it's colorectal cancer, it's something people don't necessarily like to talk about. It's not, you know, over Thanksgiving, you're not talking about, hey, grandma, how's your colon cancer, you know? So sometimes people don't know that they have that family history, but that's where I really encourage them to ask the questions, ask the hard questions, and try to dig and ask, hey, my great aunt's still alive. Let me see if she knows about my family history. So trying to ask those questions and talking about it is really important. Outside of that, I mean, if you really don't know, I mean, there is genetic testing for like polyposis syndromes that you can have done.
And on the genetics, there is genetic components that increase your risk, but those are a minority of cases. Most cases are sporadic or just arise on their own. They aren't from a genetic syndrome.
Let's talk brass tacks here. What should patients expect during a colonoscopy? Tell us what happens, especially for those who have never had one.
You want me to do it? Okay. So yeah. So like I kind of discussed a little bit with the prep. So you're doing a clear liquid diet the day before, and then which means you're not fasting. You can still drink lots of liquids, and then you start taking some pills, and then you take powder that night, and then the next morning you take pills and powder again. You come in. You can't have anything to eat or drink. You can't have any more clear liquids for at least 4 hours before the procedure. Then if you're having it with anesthesia, you'll meet with an anesthesiologist. If you're having a different type of moderate sedation, then you'll talk with the endoscopist.
And I want to stop you right there.
Mm-hmm.
You told me off mic that there are many different ways to approach how that component of a colonoscopy works, including
no sedation.
And people choose to do that.
There are patients that choose no sedation. Yes, it can be done. It's a little uncomfortable, and sometimes it's a mind over matter thing where you have to really be mentally prepared to breathe through it. But in all honesty, the most discomfort is really just the first 5 to 10 minutes when you're just making your way to the cecum. So you have to get around a few twists and turns in the colon, and then once you make it to the end, then the rest is really easy, because on the way back, there's minimal discomfort, and if we take out any polyps, you don't feel that. Really, the only pain that you get in the colon is when there's distension or as you're going around those turns.
So one thing I wondered about was for someone who's single and doesn't have a ride home from the hospital, at least not an easy arrangement to make. This is an option.
It is.
For folks in those shoes.
Absolutely. So don't let that hinder you from not having a colonoscopy. You can do it unsedated. And that way you can then do your procedure and go home and drive home the same day, or you go right back to work again and just go right back into functioning. It can be done that way.
Dr. Nwani, I think you said earlier that lifestyle factors might impact rates of colorectal cancer. Let's go into that a little bit more. What preventive measures should people be taking to make themselves less susceptible, if that's possible?
I mean, it's kind of the general education. Smoking is an increased risk factor. Obesity, unfortunately for America, is a huge risk factor, not just for colorectal cancer, but multiple diseases. Sedentary lifestyle, increasing your activity and exercise will help decrease your risk. There's certain things, but it's not a fancy science. It's all the things that everyone preaches that improves your health overall will also improve your risks related to colorectal cancer.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Dustin Nwotny. He's a general surgeon for Essentia Health, and also Dr. Kimberly Kolkhurst. She is a gastroenterologist for Essentia Health. Once colorectal or colon cancer is detected, generally, what happens next?
Well, typically, so I'll do the colonoscopy, and I can pretty much tell if something looks like it's a colon cancer. If we find it early enough, and if it's like a polyp on a stalk, it kind of looks like a mushroom on a stalk, sometimes I can even remove that endoscopically during the colonoscopy. And if it hasn't gone through the layers of the colon, we could actually remove a colon cancer endoscopically. And that patient is done. They don't end up needing any kind of surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, nothing. But if it's a type of thing where it's more advanced and it's too big to remove endoscopically, then typically I'll biopsy it. Then I put a little tattoo marker in there. Then in the recovery, I'll talk to the patients and say, I'm concerned, I think we found a colon cancer. And then typically wait a few days to get the biopsy to confirm that. And then I place a referral to our oncology doctors, and then I place a referral to our surgeon.
And generally then, people are presented options for treatment.
Yeah, so then they come into our clinic in general surgery. We usually have pretty good access. So honestly, it's been times where Dr. Kokos for putting in that consult and I see that person the next day. We do kind of discuss all the treatment options for colorectal cancer, generally surgery and surgical excision is first. The type of surgery is kind of dependent on the location. And then also part of the workup for that is usually some additional imaging to ensure that the cancer hasn't spread anywhere or any concerning lymph nodes, and then also some laboratory evaluation at the same time.
What advancements have there been in surgical techniques? Have they improved outcomes for folks?
Yeah, so there's always a lot of research on ensuring that you're doing the most oncologically correct and safest treatment, which deals with taking out a specific margin of the around the tumor, but also taking out the lymph nodes to ensure staging is accurate. In surgical technique, that's all been refined over decades of time, but we're advancing and using more technology such as robotic assistance in the operating room to help kind of minimize the surgical or incisional impact on patients and help try to expedite and improve recovery.
What misinformation is out there, and I'll give you both the opportunity to answer this question, that you just want to debunk right now about either colonoscopies or colon cancer?
I think the biggest one is I think patients need to realize this can happen to anyone. So you don't necessarily have to have a family history. You don't have to necessarily have risk factors. This is happening, and we for the most part, don't know why. We know risk factors, and there's still a lot of research that needs to go on to find out why is this happening in these patients that don't have a family history. They're not a smoker, they're not an alcoholic, they're not obese. It's really interesting looking at the diet, the processed foods, the red meats, and then there was a new study that just came out actually that was talking about seed oil, and that seed oils are increasing the risk for colorectal cancer. And seed oils are vegetable oils, so that's like canola oil, safflower oil, sunflower oil. So the good ones are olive oil and avocado oil, because those are more fruit oils. But the seed oils, the vegetable oils, they're in salad dressing. You know, like we think we're being healthy by eating a salad, but the dressings that we're using have these vegetable or these seed oils, and then the seed oils are increasing inflammation in the colon, which might be why you're getting that inflammatory response started, and then that's increasing the risk for colon cancer.
Dr. Nwatney?
I want to kind of piggyback on that, and people, a lot of people are thinking they don't have symptoms, why should I get a colonoscopy? Screening is the number one way colon cancer is found. And so I would echo just any sort of screening, like I mentioned earlier. Anything is better than nothing. Colonoscopy is the gold standard, but if you're gonna do something, that's better than nothing. The other aspect of it that I get to deal with a lot is people come in with a minor understanding of what's called an ostomy or what everyone refers to as the bag. Not all colorectal surgery or colon surgery requires that portion of the procedure. It is a discussion that's held because it is always potentially an option. But I would say the vast majority of patients that I get to treat nowadays do not require a bag after the surgery.
When I had my colonoscopy, it was a little over 8 years ago, and the doctor said, yeah, come back in 10 years. Is that the kind of the pace that people who don't have any polyps detected or any incidents still have today? Or are you recommending generally you need to have a quicker pace every 5 years or so?
Yeah, what you're describing is average risk. So if your average risk for colon cancer and you do your screening colonoscopy, which should start at the age of 45 now, and if you don't have a family history of colon cancer and you don't have a personal history of polyps, no IBD, no familial polyposis syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, okay, which is Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. So if you come in, your average risk, you have a colonoscopy and you have no polyps, then you don't need the next one for 10 years. But if we do take out any polyps, if they're the precancerous type or if there's family history of colon cancer, then we recommend those patients typically come in every 5 to 7 years for their repeat colonoscopies. They just get monitored a little bit more closely.
I'm listening to this conversation and I don't have insurance. I can't afford this. What's the message to folks like that?
Don't let that hinder you. We've got to get this screening done, because I've had so many patients that have had colon cancer. And the number one thing that they say is, I wish I had had my screening colonoscopy because I could have prevented this. So there's ways. We have financial assistance that can help get you through it, and you know, you should still get it done.
Does this all start with a discussion with your general practitioner?
Yes, that's the best way to go about it, is to reach out to your primary care doctor and say, hey, I haven't had any screening for colon cancer. Where do I start?
And for folks that even don't have a relationship, are there public health options that can get this started?
Yeah, there's different coalitions throughout the state of North Dakota, but every state kind of has their own coalition. And I want to say it's the North Dakota Cancer Coalition or Cancer Committee Coalition. They have all these screening events and education events that are out there and can provide a lot of those options in education.
I think I asked this at the top, and now I'm reflecting, and I don't think we got an actual answer. Do we know whether North Dakota has more or maybe fewer cases of colorectal cancer compared to other states in the country?
Nationwide, I think we're about the same as the rest of the country. I think the three A's, so awareness, advocacy, and then access, are the main things for colorectal cancer. So getting more people to talk about it, and then learning about this and understanding, and also helping to get rid of that fear. People, they have this fear going into a colonoscopy. I don't know what I'm going to find. I don't know what it's going to be like. But after you have it done, that fear is gone, you know. And then advocating for more research, and then improving access for patients that don't have insurance, or if they, you know, if they live in rural places, to help improve, finding ways to get them transportation. All of those things that we need to do to help improve screening rates.
Prevention is always less expensive and less painful than a cure.
Yes.
And I do want to piggyback on that episode of fear. If you do unfortunately get diagnosed, there are treatment options. We're moving more and more to minimally invasive surgery, quicker recovery out of the hospital. Obviously, like I mentioned, less need for colostomy bags or ostomies in the future. And there are options, and people nowadays in early stage cancer, our survival rates are greater than 90%.
That's good to know. March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. You enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Dustin Nowotny. He's a general surgeon at Essentia Health, and Dr. Kimberly Colkhurst. She's a gastroenterologist. To both of you, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Great. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, specializing in helping new and established investors hit their goals from single family to commercial investing. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 17th. The Cannonball River got its name from the stones found in its waters and along its banks that are so round and smooth that they greatly resemble cannonballs. The spherical rocks vary in diameter, with sizes like musket balls, baseballs, cannonballs, and even boulders, 2 feet tall. Area residents often removed the round rocks as souvenirs, often finding them where the Cannonball River joined the Missouri River, 45 miles south of Bismarck. A legend arose, questionable in its truth, about the stones. In 1889, a writer explored the mystery of the origins of the Cannonball River. This special correspondence for Iowa's Sioux City Journal spun a tale of the day when the heavens fell in a battle between the Dakota people and the Crow tribe. It was a time of incessant intertribal warfare with a great loss of life, supposedly set in the late 1840s. As the tale was told, the Dakota were much beleaguered and took refuge in a stronghold. The Dakota leader, Long Red Dog, reportedly told his people, "The Crows have reinforced their already powerful army, and we are doomed to die an ignominious death. The Crows will swoop down upon our devoted children and destroy everything in their path. We must flee for our lives." In gloomy resignation, the Dakota made a hasty flight. When they reached the shore of the Cannonball River, their scouts discovered the advance guard of the Crows on a hilltop, not a half mile distant, making further flight out of the question. The Dakota determined to fight the foe to the bitter end. A terrible battle raged, and just when the Dakota were weakening, a legendary storm arose. The daylight turned into a night as dark as ink, and the heavens rained down falling stones, pelting the Crow warriors, killing many, and causing the rest to flee, never to return. Marvelously, not a single member of the Dakota tribe had been hit by the molten stones. On this date in 1890, a reprinting of the reputed Cannonball River legend appeared in a Minnesota newspaper. Was this tale true? Was it a cleverly devised fable? Could it be that the thousands of cannonball stones along the Cannonball River testified to its truth? Perhaps it is an unbelievable story. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Monday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And we would love to hear from you. We often get story ideas from our listeners, and you can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on Main Street, John Harris from the Prairie Pulse television show will visit with Aaron Hemi Frostley, an English instructor at Concordia College. They'll explore social media's role in news, misinformation, and media literacy. She'll discuss her journalism background, her course Shades of Truth, and the impact of AI on content creation. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.